Yay!
The lost is found. We'll all rejoice.
I believe, yeah, there's a rejoice with me, and she's supposed to take her found silver and share it among her neighbors, yeah.
Throw a party for us now? Yeah, 10:30, right? Come to your party.
Maybe not everybody's here yet, but I want to follow up on something from yesterday. I got a problem in that I didn't sleep very good the night before, so I was drowsing part of the time. You may have noticed that. And so if you did talk about this, you don't have to talk about it anymore, but chapter 41, verse 21. There's something I've never noticed before.
Yeah.
After the bad cows ate the good cows, it says, but when they had eaten them, no one would have known that they had done so, for they were still as ugly as before. Mm-hmm. Now, what is that about? Now, Gina went and looked up in another verse. You can tell what you found, Gina.
Oh, I looked at, I couldn't find anything else. I looked at the Biblia, Hebraic Eshtugardensia, and I found that actually they were translating it as evil.
Uh-huh.
So they were evil. But the other thing I found was in the Masoretic text, they say that the lean cows came among the fat cows, mm-hmm, rather than eating them. Because, and Ron was thinking, well, okay, so there was still, you know, evil in the land, that things were still pretty bad, and evil is more descriptive, perhaps, if you're going that way, than ugly would be.
Mm-hmm. And there must be some
evil
significance
has a moral
to it, or they wouldn't have added that verse, would they? I mean,
well, there's a couple things about it. These skinny cows come out, but they don't eat, and you would expect them to eat, right? That's what the fat cows were doing. They don't eat until they eat up the fat cows, but it makes no difference. The interpretation that I draw from that is that the famine was so severe that it was as if the fat cows hadn't even been there, or the fat cows couldn't influence the severity of the famine. Now, of course, they do end up influencing the severity of the famine, because Joseph takes the fat cow years and he stores a lot of the grain and is able to give it back out to people during the lean years. But just before Joseph's intervention, you know, the good times would be gone.
Do you think it could be saying that even after the 7 years, it was kind of a period of minor recession, so that it took them a while to get back in gear?
Even after the 7 years of famine?
Yeah.
I don't know. I wonder how long it took them to get back in.
How about also? We talk about people who have sort of a lean and hungry look.
Mm-hmm.
Young Cassius?
Yeah.
And I think some people who have that lean and hungry look, you know, could sit down and eat through several Ponderosa tables,
yeah,
and still have that lean and hungry look at it, which is part of their
personality. They're never satisfied, they're just always, Alrighty. Hey, we're ready to roll the tape now. I look up to the tape
gods,
tape deities, or whoever they are.
I notice everybody says, does that mean everything gets recorded?
Yep.
Yes.
And it's voice activated?
There's somebody, I think, waiting to turn the tape on at the beginning, and then they just trust that it will run through the rest of the session without a problem. And speakers have given permission for it to either be taped for private use or taped to be put on the website. So in the future, you'll be able to go onto the Holden website and access MP3 files of all your favorite speakers and all the ones you're not here to hear. So that's kind of exciting. I learned yesterday, I think, not to read over much and to have more time for conversation, even though the story is so good and there are details in it that we haven't seen, because perhaps we haven't read it closely and in a leisurely kind of way since we were
in Sunday school. This is a great Sunday school story. I know I memorized a lot of ins and outs about it, but not everything. And coming back and looking at it is revelatory. Nonetheless, since we're looking at chapters 42 to 44 today, we won't read the entire thing. We'll read sections of it. Let me tell you about the general shape of it. Now that Joseph has addressed the needs of the famine by interpreting Pharaoh's dreams, by gathering up stockpiling grain, and by finding a way to give the grain out to hungry people, now the arc of the story is able to return to what happened at the beginning in chapter 37, namely, the discord in Joseph's own family is going to become come to the fore again. And the ark of salvation that God has provided, I don't mean ARK, but ARC, the ark of salvation that God has provided to feed hungry people has already reached a very good stage. And now God even has more surprises up God's sleeve in that this world crisis and world amelioration or benefit that Joseph is bringing is also going to provide the stage for the family to reconcile. So there will be salvation, there will be shalom, not just for the big world, but also for this particular family. And if chapters 39, 40, and 41 were kind of self-contained about Joseph in Egypt, and he didn't mention his family much, if at all, I think maybe when he said, "My son, I'm giving him a name that allows me to forget my father." That's about the only mention of Joseph's troubled past right there. Well, now this whole thing about Egypt is sort of like the backstage, and the family really comes to the fore again. And so 37 jumps right up here to 42, 43, 44. And in 42, it's a nice symmetrical chapter in that there's the first meeting of Joseph with his brothers in Egypt, and then his brothers go back home and they have two meetings with their father, one when they get home and report what happened, and then another meeting sometime later when it's clear that they're going to have to go back to Egypt. And then the chapter ends with that second meeting between Joseph and his brothers in Egypt. And then that meeting is quite involved and continues to some raveling and unraveling of what's going on in the family and in the hearts of the brothers. So let us pray. Prayer from Walter Brueggemann that I thought fit today pretty well. A people with many secrets. You are the God from whom no secret can be hid, and we are a people with many secrets that we want to tell for the sake of our lives, that we dare not tell because they are deep and painful. But they are our secrets, and they count for much. They are our truth, rooted deep in our lives. You are the God of all truth, and now we bid you heed our truth, about which we will not bear false witness. The truth of grief unresolved, the truth of pain unacknowledged, the truth of fear too childlike, the truth of hate as powerful as it is deep, the truth of being taken advantage of and being used and manipulated and slandered. We trust the great truth of your wondrous love, but we will not sit still for it until you hear us. Our truth, heard by you, will make us free. So be the God of all truth, even ours. We pray in the name of Jesus, who is your best kept secret of hurt. Amen. I'm going to suggest, this is my thesis about this family drama in this part of Genesis. I'm going to suggest that Joseph has hardened into a bureaucrat of the empire who has a lot of power, and he can use his power as he wishes. And when his brothers come and he recognizes them, he shows himself to be ruthless and calculating. He is the typical, or he's the premier example of the wise man. You know, King Solomon's court, David's court, they wanted people to be wise, to have knowledge close to the ground, and to be able to do something with their knowledge for the benefit of the common good. And that's how Joseph is presented here. He's kind of a model of a wise man. Remember Pharaoh in the previous chapter called him wise and discerning. And Joseph is that, but he's also closed off a compassionate part of himself. And he's willing to use his technical knowledge to manipulate people. He uses his technical knowledge to save the Egyptians and anyone else who comes for food. We saw yesterday, though, that he actually used that power to make Pharaoh more grand and more of a centralized power than he had been before. So there was some question about the ethics from a Jewish point of view of what was happening in Egypt, what Joseph, who was Jewish, was party to in Egypt. And now I think I understand, there's a couple ways you can understand Joseph as he deals with his brothers here. And one way is he knows their guilt and he's going to set up a situation where they have to have their noses rubbed in it and they'll come face to face with it and they'll see the light and they'll repent. But I don't see Joseph that way. What I'm suggesting to you is I see him as someone who is hardened by his life and has buried those griefs of the past. And when his brothers come, he does want revenge, but I'm not sure that he thinks that they're going to get it, that they're going to repent, that there will be reconciliation. So he starts from a position of, well, I'm going to give them theirs. And I don't know that he has hope for anything better. But what happens, surprisingly, is that his brothers do change. And the two together, Joseph and his brothers, and also the involvement of their father, cause a change in both sides so that the family is reconciled and knit together again. And I think I can show you how Joseph melts step by step by step. And I think that we can look at his brothers, and particularly his brother Judah, and see how Judah steps up to the plate in an important way and does something that changes things for Joseph. That's my thesis. That's the way I read it. And you might read it differently, but let's go into it, and I'll try to show you where I see these things happening. So we start with Joseph, who's willing to manipulate people from the position that he's in. He has power knowledge, but he doesn't have the power of compassion. So let's watch Joseph develop compassion and how it happens. Let's go to chapter 42, verses 6 through 20. Again, I'll read from Everett Fox, who has a translation where he tries to stick closely to the Hebrew, and you can follow along in your whatever translation you have with you this morning. 42. The beginning of 42, Jacob has said to his sons, I hear there are rations in Egypt. You better go down there that we might live. So 10 of the brothers go down, but Jacob will not allow Benjamin to go down, lest harm befall him. Now, 42 verses 6 through, what did I say?
20.
Now, Joseph was the governor over the land. It was he who supplied rations to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed low to him, brow to the ground. Wait, where did you hear that before? That was in Joseph's dream in chapter 37. He saw the sun, the moon, and the stars bowing low to him. He saw the 11 sheaves of his brother bowing low to his sheaf. Well, this is almost exactly that, except they don't have sheaves. They're in a famine, and he's got all the sheaves. But here they are. The dream is being fulfilled. They are bowing low to him, brow to the ground. when Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended no recognition of them and spoke harshly with them. Remember what they did to him at the beginning? They wouldn't speak a good word to him. They wouldn't say shalom to him. They were always speaking to him harshly. Well, now here he is speaking harshly to them. He said to them, "From where do you come?" They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food rations." Now, although Joseph recognized his brothers, for their part, they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamt of them. What do you think is the significance of that? What is he remembering about those dreams?
This is a device of the storyteller to bring his audience back to that point, so that they remember that's what's coming up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did it have any meaning for Joseph that he remembered it?
Well, it provides him motivation.
Mm. Well, or it says, oh, the dream was right.
So he might have a sense of hopefulness from it. God is at work here and God will bring things out. He might have a sense of disgust, you know. See, I was right all along and these brothers treated me this way. We don't know, but it raises questions about that. So he said to them, "You are spies. It's to see the nakedness of the land that you have come." The nakedness, the vulnerability of the land, you know. Egypt is rich, you're not, and you're trying to figure out some way to exploit this. He's basically accusing them of being like terrorists. They said to him, "No, my lord, rather your servants have come to buy food rations. We are all of us the sons of a single man. We are honest. Your servants have never been spies." But he said to them, "No, for it's the nakedness of the land you've come to see." They said, "Your servants are 12. Oh my gosh, I think that is a significant word right there. There are 10 of them there right now, and yet they talk about themselves collectively as a family. And Joseph has been gone from their family for like 22 years. And they still say, 'Your servants are 12, we are brothers.'" I wonder what Joseph hears in that moment. I wonder if he realizes that to them he was never dead, as he assumed he must have been. "Your servants are 12, we are brothers, sons of a single man in the land of Canaan. And the youngest is with our father now, and one is no more." And yet, although they think he is no more, they haven't forgotten him. I wonder what that means to Joseph. Joseph said to them, "It is just as I spoke to you, saying, 'You are spies. Hereby shall you be tested.'" Notice the language that Joseph uses, whether he's doing this out of his own pain and hurt, or whether he's just doing it as a test for them, is the language of test and proof. It's cold and calculating language. And he wants to see how they're going to measure up. It's law. It's not gospel. So Joseph says, "Hereby shall you be tested, as Pharaoh lives." He's being as Egyptian as he can, so there's no chance they'll recognize him. "You shall not depart from this place unless your youngest brother comes here." Now Joseph has his own reasons for saying that. He wants to see his brother Benjamin, but from their point of view it makes sense, because they said, We're a family. We're not a nation state that's out to get Egypt. We're just a family, and we're 10 brothers. We're 12 brothers, and our youngest brother is at home. And so this Egyptian is saying, okay, prove that you really are this kind of family and that you do have a youngest brother at home. Bring him here. So that makes sense to them, even though it's a word of horror to them. Joseph continues, verse 16, "Send one of you to fetch your brother while the rest of you remain as prisoners. Thus will your words be tested, whether there is truth in you or not. As Pharaoh lives, indeed, you are spies." He removed them into custody for 3 days. So they have their moment in the pit. Joseph said to them on the third day, "Do this and stay alive, for I fear God. If you are honest, let one of your brothers be held prisoner in the house of your custody. And as for you, go bring back rations for the famine supply of your households. Then bring your youngest brother back to me, so that your words will be proven truthful, and you will not die." They prepared to do so. How are you reading Joseph at this point? What do you think his aim is in dealing with his brothers here?
Revenge.
Hmm. Now comes what seems to me to be a turning point in 21 to 24. This is the brothers talking with each other. "But they said, each man to his brother, 'Truly we are guilty concerning our brother, that we saw his heart's distress when he implored us, and we did not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us.'" Here they're talking about what their guilt is. They don't have to say, "Because we threw our brother into the pit and sold him into slavery." But they do say, "We saw his heart's distress when he implored us, and we did not listen." The word for listen is the word Shema. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one." It's a key thing. And it's so true of so many families. Joseph had called out, and they didn't listen. That was what broke their family apart. Joseph had dreams, and they didn't listen to the dreams. Even his doting father didn't want to listen to the import of the dreams that Joseph had. And now the punishment that they're feeling, the guilt that they're feeling, fits the crime that they did. They said it caused us. He had distress, now we have distress. So there's this kind of even-handed justice that's happened. And I almost get the picture that these brothers have been frozen in time since this horrific event 22 years earlier, when they tossed Joseph in the pit and then he disappeared and they didn't really know what happened to him. It's like, how do you deal with grief and guilt and culpability like that when you can't tell anyone? And it just stays locked up inside. And now all of a sudden, they've been in a pit for 3 days, and things start breaking loose for them. And they say, "We saw that he was calling out, and we didn't listen."
It also reminds me, I just got a book by Pauline Boss about ambiguous loss, and their experience of him being taken away fits her categories of ambiguity. So there is no body to bury. You can't end the process, but it just hangs there. And so for people who lost loved ones in Nam, but the body never came home, and those kinds of ambiguous losses mm-hmm. are more powerful.
Mm-hmm. And is ambiguous also in the sense of, I mean, they were relieved that their hated brother was gone, and yet they knew there was something awful about it. It's ambiguous that way. They don't know whether to... They can't just rejoice, but they sure aren't ready to just cry. Yeah.
Perhaps also they've had to deal with their dad's grief for a long time.
Oh my gosh, mm-hmm. yes. Yeah. That's really clear. He says, "I'm going to go down into Sheol now, the place of the dead, and mourn for my lost son." And we basically get the picture that he's still there. He's still there. And there's a point when he hears that Joseph is alive when he's going to say, "Okay, I'm resurrected." You know, he'll come back to life at that point. He's just been in this gray state of grief for a long time. And they have had to deal with it. And at first, how they dealt with it at first was like, you know, "Oh, whew, he took the conclusion that Joseph was eaten by a wild animal. And, you know, we don't have to confess our part in it." But now we're going to see that they handle their father's grief differently. Now, after this moment when the ice begins to thaw. Reuben, you remember who he is, the firstborn. Reuben answered them saying, "Didn't I say to you, say, do not sin against the child? But you would not listen. So for his blood now satisfaction is demanded." Now they did not know that Yosef was listening. for a translator was between them. You see how the narrator uses this theme of listening. So just for a moment, think of a time in your life when someone should have listened to you and didn't.
It's not quite the same thing, but particularly with foreign languages, people take it for granted that you can't understand their language. Mm-hmm. And so they'll say things that they expect you not to understand. I was in Israel one time, and there were a group of German tourists behind me. And the German tourists were talking back and forth about how lousy their tour operator was, and you know what a terrible place this was, and they just weren't enjoying this at all. And what I wanted to say is, do you think nobody else speaks German? You know?
Yeah.
Think people don't hear what you're saying?
Yeah. And in 24, Joseph's response, but he turned away from them and wept. The first of three occasions in these three chapters where he weeps. Aviva Zornberg says, Joseph sheds most of the tears in Genesis. The only time you hear of other people weeping is when Jacob and Esau are reconciled after their time away from each other and the hostility between them. They fall on each other's necks and weep. And otherwise, weeping is mentioned only of Joseph. And this is the first of three times when he weeps. So what's starting to happen for Joseph? This is where I see the ice breaking for him too. I don't just see that he was manipulating them and hoping this would happen. I think he really was doing what he needed to do, but now there's a little crack that wasn't there before.
Well, now he realizes that at least one of his brothers thought it wasn't a terribly good idea. Which he must not have known to begin with.
Well, how could he know that? Yeah, how could he know that? And, you know, they hadn't come looking for him. It's also interesting, with all of his power and influence, he could have written to his father or sent a message to his father previously saying, how are you? You know, don't let my brothers know, they don't like me. But he never did that. So it really has been, for whatever reason, it's been an alienation, and he's been alone, and he's assimilated into this foreign culture, and he's done a load of good for them and for his whole part of the world. I think for the whole world as they knew it. And yet there's this unresolved grief on his part, which is now starting to get some attention. Okay. Klaus Westermann says that verse 21 is key for the brothers. They experience freedom in the confession of their sin. And he wants us to notice that this is not, they go to church and they confess their sins and they receive absolution, but this is a story where confession of forgiveness happens in real people's lives, where it's supposed to happen. I mean, if we do it in church, it's in order to practice the moves so that we can do it when we hurt other people in the other parts of our lives. So that we are more ready to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong, please forgive me. Or to say, I do forgive you. That should happen in real time, in real places, and that's where it's happening in this story. Although it's kind of a high exalted dramatic story, I'll admit that. Now, the brothers, you know, at the end of this meeting, Simon is taken away from them and put into prison. And then Joseph fills their sacks with grain, and he also gives them their silver back. This is something for the readers of the story. The story doesn't ever make a connection with, you know, they had sold Joseph for 20 pieces of silver, and here the silver is given back to them. We know that. The listeners know that. They're not aware of that level of correspondence. But that's okay, because what's happening in this part of the story is a lot of the details of Joseph's fall and being thrown into the pit and being sold into slavery are repeated. We'll see another one the second time that they come to Egypt. So they go back home and they discover this silver and they go, wow, what is this? And
what has, verse 28, what is this that God has done to us? They know that something big is happening here, but these poor brothers, just imagine them. It's like their whole sense of reality is being shaken up, and they don't know what's right, what's wrong, what's coming, what's going, whether they're guilty, whether they're not guilty. I mean, they just are in some, like Alice in Wonderland land, which seems to them very strange. And it's no wonder that when they get home and talk to their father, they put off returning to Egypt as long as possible. Mm-hmm. So their first conversation with Yaakov, their father, in the land of Canaan, they tell him what had befallen. And they say, you know, if we go back, we're going to have to take Benjamin with us. And their father says, verse 36, it's me that you bereave. Yosef is no more. Shimon is no more. Now you take Benjamin. Upon me has all this come. Talk about someone who is in grief and mourning. And then Reuben. Here's where there's a difference in their reaction. They're starting to see their father's grief and accept it. I mean, even though this is a rascally old man who never gave them the time of day and had so much favoritism for this, the sons of his one wife, Rachel, but not of their mothers. This asshole father of theirs, nonetheless. Reuben, the firstborn, says, all right, you know, if we don't bring Benjamin back, you can put my two sons to death if you want. Well, Jacob won't take it. That wouldn't be a good substitute. I mean, the death of one son and the death of two grandsons somehow doesn't add up to making the situation better in his mind. But he just said, And so they don't go back to Egypt right away. But eventually they have to. Chapter 43 sends them back at the beginning. And now another brother steps up. Not Reuben. But verse 2, so it was when they finished eating the rations that they brought from Egypt, their father said to them, he's still the motivator in sending them down there, return, buy us some food rations. Judah, or Yehuda in Hebrew, says, yeah, but you remember what that's going to mean. We're going to have to take Benjamin with us. And Yisrael, Jacob, complains at them a little bit, like, you know, well, why did you even talk to this guy about our family situation? He didn't even need to know any of this. And then they're going, well, he asked us, and, you know, we weren't guilty or anything, so we just thought we should tell him, and we did. And then Yehuda steps up to the plate, Judah, in verse 8, and he says to Israel, his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die from the famine. So we, so you, so our little ones. I mean, our whole future as a family depends on our entering this risk with our brother Benjamin, who's got to be at least, by the way, you know, 23, 24 years old. And Judah goes on to say, I will act at his as his pledge. And this is a legal formula. He's making an oath that would stand up in court. He could be convicted on not carrying this out because he's saying it twice in parallel ways. That's the official way of making an oath. I will act as his pledge. At my hand, you may seek him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him in your presence, I will be culpable for sin against you all the days of my life. So now there is this idea of responsibility for a brother that the brothers are taking. That's a change in this family. And so Yisrael says, verse 11, if it must be so, then do this. And here's where another detail from earlier in the story comes back. Jacob, Israel, is saying, you know, butter this Egyptian official up. Take some of the produce of the land in your vessels and bring them down to the man as a gift. A little balsam, a little honey, balm and ladanum, pistachio nuts and almonds. And of course we got this wretched silver that he sent back before. Take that back too and take more. I mean, they don't have the foodstuffs, the staples that they need to live on. They have these little cash crops, kind of, but what good does that do when you're hungry for the bread that's going to fill your stomach? So anyhow, take that down to him and impress him. Take all the money and
As for your brother, he says, take him. Arise, return to the man, and may God Shaddai give you mercy before the man. This is the name for God that his father Isaac used when he had gone, when Jacob left to go away to his uncle Laban's place. His father said, God Shaddai, go before you. And he picks up that name and uses it, so that he releases your other brother to you and Benjamin as well. As for me, if I must be bereaved, I must be bereaved. He's willing to take the whole family grief on him. He's just like a rock. So they went down there. And then they get back to Egypt just in about one verse. And then in 16 through, so chapter 43, verse 16 through 44, 34 is their second meeting with the official in Egypt that they don't know is their brother. And I'll just pick, let me just check here what I want to do here. Well, they're very anxious when they get there. The first thing is they're invited into the house of this Egyptian, and they know that that's not how things usually go. And again, they don't know if it's good or if it's bad. They really have no clue. They're terrified. They sort of stammer out to the steward of Joseph's house, you know, is it because of the money? Does he? Well, we brought the money back. I mean, he doesn't think we stole the money, does he? But the steward says, verse 23, Shalom Lachaim, peace be with you. It's well with you. Do not be afraid. Your God, the God of your father, placed a treasure in your packs for you. I have all the silver I need. Your silver has come in to me. He's saying, your bill's been paid in full. Don't worry about that. So the fact that you have silver, I mean, that's just a blessing from God. This has got to be great cognitive dissonance for them. Because, like, what? You know, they were desperate. They were coming back for food, and they're greeted with peace. They're greeted with a meal. They get to come inside. As Gina pointed out, it's an interesting situation where they all sit separately. Even the Hebrew, the brothers sit separately in their own room, and then the Egyptians would eat separately. But even the Egyptians eat separately, and then Joseph himself eats separately. Because it's an abomination, it says, for Egyptians to eat with Hebrews. Well, I think that what that's setting up in the story is it's going to be easier for Joseph to have a private meeting with them in the future. He'll be able to send people away, and because he's got this private room where he eats, and the other people won't question him when they get sent away, and then they'll have their own private stage for their big reconciliation. Sometimes the bad rules of a place can be used for good, I guess. Again, verse 26, when Joseph came into the house, they brought him the gift that was in their hand into the house and bowed down to him to the ground. Again, the dream is being fulfilled. Then Joseph says to them, he asked after their shalom and said, is your old father, does he have shalom of whom you spoke? Is he still alive? They said, your servant, our father, does have shalom. He is still alive. And in homage, they bowed low. Again, the dream is seeking its fulfillment. Then Joseph lifted up his eyes, verse 29, and saw Benjamin, his brother, his mother's son. And he said, is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me? And he said, may God show you favor, my son. This phrase, may God show you favor, occurs here and in Numbers 6, verse 25, the Lord bless you and keep you, the Lord's face shine on you and be gracious to you, the Lord look upon you with favor and give you peace. This is a very exalted word, and Joseph is giving that kind of blessing to his brother right here. And in haste, for his feelings were so kindled toward his brother that he had to weep, Joseph entered a chamber and wept there. You see that his feelings are more and more breaking up. This time he's crying so copiously that he has to go in another room to get his composure before he can come back. Washes his face, comes out, restrains himself and says, I wanted to comment on his feelings were so kindled. This is also a little bit of an unusual word, and it's one that's used in Hosea 11 of how God feels about the nation of Israel, the people of Israel. And here it said that's how Joseph felt about his brother Benjamin. It's an ardent longing and love and passion that Joseph feels for his brother Benjamin. And so we notice in this section that things are starting to shift. Shalom is offered. The brothers are bowing. Joseph is weeping. They eat together. You know what a meal means, to share a meal, even though they do this in this awkward sort of way in three different rooms. To share a meal means that you're family, that you extend the hospitality and protection and safety of your place to the other people. Is Joseph giving a message that he's not really ready to give yet? Is like his action preceding where his emotions are? Is he giving them mixed messages? Oh boy, he's giving them mixed messages, because the next thing that happens is he sends them home and he frames them. In fact, he frames his youngest brother Benjamin as one who has stolen his precious cup. Notice at the end of verse 34, he's been feeding them and he's had five times the amount of food that anyone else got given to Benjamin. And they drank and became drunk with him. I mean, they just are partying. And well, they don't know exactly what's going on, but they're just going to relax and take advantage of this hospitality. But that sets it up for this cup, this special cup that's not just a drinking cup, but that it is said it's Joseph's divination cup. It's a cup he uses for telling the future. He can maybe look at how the wine drips down the inside of the cup, or he can look at the surface of the wine or something like that, and he's supposed to be able to tell the future. This special cup ends up being found in Benjamin's pack after the brothers go away, and then Joseph sends the guy from his household out after them to say, "You stole my cup. Let's look. Oh yeah, there it is. It's Benjamin." Well, it probably is a capital punishment, capital offense, to steal a cup that's used for a religious ceremony like divination. And so it's probably not out of bounds to say, "Oh, we got to take Benjamin back and kill him." And it's very interesting to see the whole agony that the brothers go through, because of course they don't think anything's wrong. And at the beginning they're saying, "Heaven forbid your servants to do such a thing. You know, we returned the silver that we found. You know, why would we steal silver again? I'll tell you, if you find anything here, we'll all be your slaves." They can say that because they think everything's just fine and dandy. And then when the goblet is found in Benjamin's pack, then they're tearing their clothes, verse 13, in chapter 44, this is mourning. I mean, they're already giving up, like, and they have to put all their things back on their donkeys and go back to the city. Judah and his brothers came into Joseph's house. Again, Judah is going to be the spokesman for all. He's not the oldest brother, but he's the one who has, remember, stepped up to the father. And back in the beginning, there was chapter 37, and then we continued with 39, 40, 41, the story of Joseph. Chapter 38 was all about Judah, and it was all about his maturation. It's a very odd and unusual story, and I don't have time to go into it now. But you can read that and you can see that there Judah grows up a fair piece. And so here he continues to have that kind of leadership. And so he's going to interface with Joseph now on behalf of all the brothers. They fling themselves down before him to the ground. This is the fourth time that they've done that. Joseph says, "What kind of deed is this that you've done?" Judah says, verse 16, "What can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? By what could we show ourselves innocent? God has found out your servant's crime." Which crime do you think he's talking about?
When they put him in a pit, probably.
Yeah. And even though he doesn't know this is Joseph, he knows that their lives have been broken since that happened. And that somehow this confusion and this being blamed is somehow just deserts. It somehow fits, it's the right punishment for that long-standing brokenness that has skewed their lives. Well then,
He maintains, verse 17, this is still Judah. Heaven forbid, excuse me, this is Joseph. Let me go back to the end of verse 16. Judah says, here we are, servants to my Lord, so the one in whose hand the goblet was found. He's at least maintaining solidarity. He's saying, you're not going to get just Benjamin away from us. We will all serve you as slaves. Joseph says, heaven forbid that I should do this. The man in whose hand the goblet was found, he shall become my servant. But you, the rest of you, go up in shalom to your father. So Joseph is really presenting like a just punishment for the crime. I don't need all of you as slaves. I just need the one who stole my cup. Now Judah came closer to Joseph and said, and that word, he drew near to Joseph, is used in three contexts in the Bible. It's used for war. Such and such an army drew near to another army. It's used for appeasement. You draw near to give somebody something that's going to calm them down. It's used for prayer. You draw near to God to pray. And some of the rabbis interpret Judah's mood here as being angry, as if to say, how the hell can you tell us to go home in peace to our father when peace is exactly what is not possible if we go home without Benjamin, who is all that our father has left as far as he's concerned? And so in anger, in righteous anger, Judah speaks one of the longest speeches in the whole Hebrew scriptures. And he tells his brother what his father is like and what they need to do to love their father properly, as their father needs to be loved. Now, just listen to Judah's kind of language here. Please, my Lord, pray let your servant speak a word in the ears of my Lord, and do not let your anger rage against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh. My Lord, Joseph, asked his servants, these brothers, saying, do you have a father or another brother? And we said to my Lord, we have an old father and a young child of his old age, whose brother is dead, so that he alone is left of his mother, and his father loves him. And you said to your servants, now what is this? Suddenly the story of Joseph and Benjamin is Judah's own story. Judah has expressed solidarity with this part of his family that he previously hated and resented. And his father's galling favoritism has even been forgiven by Judah. He's accepted it as part of the old man's craziness, the way that all of us have to accept that our parents weren't perfect and they had their sometimes vast and glaring flaws. And so Judah continues through this whole story and says, this is how it was. We went home and our father said, go back. We said, we can't go down. Without taking our youngest brother, our father says, you know, now your servant, my father, this is verse 27, said to us, you yourselves know that my wife bore two sons to me, as if he only had one wife. But, okay, Judah's going to quote him that way and let him get away with it. And in this recounting, Jacob continues, one went away from me. I said, for sure he is torn to pieces, and I have not seen him again thus far. Now, should you take away this one as well from before my face, should harm befall him, you'll bring down my gray hair to ill fortune in Sheol. I mean, this is exactly what he said when Joseph disappeared. He's going, you know, in Sheol, I'm going to stay there. And so Judah continues, so you see, it's just impossible for me to go home without Benjamin. It would kill my father. And then, in verse 32, Judah says, for your servant, that's talking about himself, pledged himself for the lad to my father, saying, if I don't bring him back to you, I will be culpable for sin against my father all the days of my life. So now, pray let your servant stay instead of the lad. Judah says, let me stay instead of Benjamin as servant to my Lord. Well, this is 180 degrees around from where he was when he said, hey, let's just sell Joseph to get rid of him. Let's not kill him. Let's sell him. Here, Judah is offering to step in as the substitute for Benjamin. And some commentators tell us this is the first time this idea has appeared in the Bible, that somebody else can substitute for someone else. Mm. That someone's life can be given for another one's life. Mm. And let the lad go up with his brothers. For how could I go up to my father when the lad is not with me? Then would I see the ill fortune that would come upon my father. So the way I read it is this conversion on Judah's part and his ability to step up and take responsibility, not only for what he did to Joseph back then, but now for the responsibility he's taken for Benjamin, really allows Joseph to let go of his idea that these people need to be tested to see if they're going to be what their character is going to be or what they're going to show him. Who knows? If Judah hadn't stepped up at this point, would Joseph have continued to manipulate them and trick them and blame them and frame them? But at this point, even though this gets into tomorrow's chapter, Joseph could no longer restrain himself in the presence of all who were stationed around him. And he weeps and wails out loud and lets himself be known to his brothers. Aviva Zornberg says, you know, Joseph here was in a pit, and only Judah knew how to get him out. Judah rewove the story, the family story, and gave a different version of it to Joseph, a version in which Joseph had been missed by the father, which was certainly true, but also by the brothers who came to have compassion for their father. And in his Judah's defining himself in the family story, he gave Joseph the opportunity to take a new definition in the story and to reveal who he was. So can families be healed? Can hungry people be fed? Which is easier?
Feeding.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me with all those brothers that they didn't think that maybe he kind of looked like them. That they didn't think, you know, maybe they sold him. He wasn't dead, or they didn't. That there wasn't some resemblance, for goodness sakes.
Technically, they didn't sell him. Technically, he disappeared from the pit, and they didn't know what had happened to him.
But if the pit was empty, they probably figured that.
They might have.
Anyway. I guess I read too many detective stories.
Well, yeah. Yul Brynner looked so different
from
the Ten Commandments than the Hebrews.
He had an Egyptian haircut.
Yeah.
Egyptian clothes.
And
Egyptian
was,
speech.
Right, and translators.
Egyptian body oils.
And he sat in another room when they ate so that they couldn't look at him that closely.
Plus he was powerful and you don't look into the eyes of anybody that powerful.
Right. Got your face down on the floor, bowing down all the time.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, that too, that one would be very disturbing to Jacob's people to bow down and have to ask somebody for food. They were used to being self-sufficient. And it says something about the, I mean, we might also give some thought to the indignity for people who have to beg for food from those who have power.
And even if you thought that it might look like my brother, I would never dare mention that.
Yeah. Right, even among yourselves?
Yeah. Well, maybe, but
I don't know, it just seems, I mean, let's face it, it's a good story.
I'm wondering what stories you have of betrayal, and if those, when you were betrayed or when you betrayed someone else, did those stories come around to reconciliation? And what were the things that thawed the ice or that helped you make the moves? You can just think about that. I mean, that's a big question that asks for vulnerability, but you may have something you want to say out loud too.
I can't answer that question, but I want to go back to a historical thing. Now, this was written long after the actual historic history. No. Wasn't the southern kingdom called Judah?
Yes.
And the northern kingdom called Israel?
Yes.
No. Could Judah have taken a special place in this story because yes. of his place, place of the Judaic kingdom,
yes.
Judaic tribe,
right.
later?
Right. Judah was the tribe that lived in the south around Jerusalem, and after the kingdom split into the north and the south, Jerusalem, which had been a compromised capital that held both parts together, Jerusalem stayed with the southern kingdom of Judah.
Judah and Benjamin.
And Benjamin. Still together, yeah. As brothers down there. And the other tribes were in the north. And so, yes, it is entirely appropriate that Judah steps up and takes a leading role. And so it's kind of a chicken egg sort of thing. I mean, he doesn't have this role in the story just because of later historical facts, but the two dovetail very nicely. Just as all of this can be read as a parable about Israel the people, as well as Israel the man and his 12 sons. It can be read as Israel the people and the 12 tribes and how they got to Egypt and so on. So that all of that echoes, has resonance.
And Judah has Jacob's, gets Jacob's blessing, passes over, what, three other sons to get down to?
Yes.
Judah.
Yes.
So that's the expectation then, that he takes on the cloak of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob.
Jacob and Judah. Yeah. Right. Right.
This is going to probably come up in the next chapters, you know, but the brothers really never quite trust his forgiveness of it.
They don't, yeah, you know, and at that, the end, well, after their father dies,
yeah,
they're kind of going, okay, now dad's dead, now we're going to get it. And Joseph has to reassure them at that point, hey, it's cool, you know, I really do forgive you. And
so
I really,
it was sort of a temporary forgiveness or something.
Yeah, good enough to go ahead, but I mean, some of these big things I think we have to do and redo and redo. I don't think we do them once and they're over with, but they work. They've worked our way into our lives so much, just like Lisa Walker's been saying about our bad habits, about the way we move. I mean, we start moving emotionally with people in certain crippled ways, and even if forgiveness and healing comes, we find that we're still crippled in some ways and we need to come back to it again and again and again to rework the forgiveness and to allow the new patterns of healing to permeate our relationships. And what about a God who would set up a trajectory where Joseph becomes a Hebrew shepherd boy, becomes a prince in Egypt in order to save the lives of many people during a terrible famine, and that also allows reconciliation in the family? I mean, you get this picture of God who is just as interested in the details of our family lives as in the global events, and vice versa, who's just as interested in what's happening on the global stage as what's happening in the details of our family lives. Wow, what a God.
This theme keeps coming back, doesn't it? Because Moses, you know, I mean, it's a similar story, and then Jesus.
What are you seeing, the connections there?
Well, you know, doesn't Moses become an Egyptian? I mean, of course, he's an adversary there, isn't he, with the Egyptian?
He is raised in the Egyptian palace.
Yeah, well, okay, for a period of time, yeah.
But he knows his Hebrew roots, and he takes offense when he sees a Hebrew being killed, mm-hmm. and has to run away.
What's the place of Egypt in all this?
Egypt, you automatically think slavery. And yet, that was a part of Israel's history. There also was this sort of fascination with things Egyptian, probably at the time of David and Solomon's court, when like the Queen of Sheba came up to see Solomon and said, my gosh, he is wealthy, he is wise, I've never seen the likes of this. You know, so there was a little bit of feeling like, you know, now we're on a par with Egypt. And then later on, when the Assyrians first and the Babylonians came in and conquered Palestine, there was some thought that maybe Egypt would provide refuge again, that they could ally with Egypt and stand up against Egypt, who was to the south and west, and stand up against these great powers who were coming from the north and the east. So they, you know, Egypt was just there in the area, and they reckoned with Egypt in many ways over the many phases of their history. But above all, Egypt, like the archetypal meaning of Egypt is, we were slaves in Egypt, but God freed us. And especially that's true of Pharaoh. I think maybe they had a little more relaxed attitude about Egypt, but Pharaoh is almost always a dirty word, post-Joseph.
Egypt in the late 20th century too provided a kind of the first Arab nation to deal with Israel in some sort of way.
Yeah. A graceful memory there. Yeah.
You mentioned pulling it in with Jesus. Egypt is respite for Mary, Joseph, and baby.
Very good. Yeah. Thanks. And that's also the symbolism then of God bringing Jesus out of Egypt, just as God brought Israel out. So the Exodus and the new liberation is remembered, and you see that Jesus will be the true Israel who lives the way Israel should have and never really did fully. Yeah.
Was it the 10 brothers who massacred that town over Dinah?
Yeah,
was
Shechem.
It
mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Red Tent story.
Yeah.
But they don't seem to have, I mean, that seemed like a bad thing.
Yeah.
But they weren't really being punished in any way for that. That's not brought up again as one of the bad things that they'd done.
You know, I think it is brought up again, if I remember, and I'd have to check this out, but I think I remember reading that on his deathbed when...
Yes, he mentioned Simeon and Levi.
When Jacob blesses them, he mentions that event. He doesn't mention Joseph being sold into slavery. He mentions
Simeon and Levi
having done that in Shechem on Dinah's behalf.
Another example why he wasn't sold into slavery by the brothers, maybe.
That's right. So tomorrow we're going to look at the most theological comments in the story in chapters 45 and 50, where Joseph says clearly, "You meant it for evil, God meant it for good." And we'll try to explore some of the mystery of how God works in ways like that and is able to bring good out of ill in all of our lives and in all of our world. So, and tonight, I get to work with Vespers tonight, and I actually decided to use the death of Jacob as the scripture tonight in Vespers. So there'll be a little special link for you there.
Proof we were here. No.
We'll be in a PowerPoint somewhere.
Oh, no, I don't think I look good enough for that.
Sorry.
I have a picture of Dan Erlander giving a PowerPoint. I told him, can you point? Now do it powerfully. And he goes,
that's PowerPoint.
And I go, that's Dan Erlander's PowerPoint.
That's great.
Good. Thank you for leaving today, but we've certainly enjoyed the...
Yes.
You're welcome.
Three out of four we were able to.
Fantastic.
When you get back, give all the people on the other side of the mountain, on the dreary side, our love. we're staying on the sunny side.
It is. It's beautiful.
Oh, the wise ones.